Okay, so this morning I hope to get about halfway through Deuteronomy chapter 5, which means covering the first four of the Ten Commandments. But I'm going to back up to chapter 4 in the reading. Start reading at Deuteronomy 4, verse 44, and try to read all the way through 5 from 22 through the giving of the Ten Commandments. The chapter divisions are not inspired, as I'm sure you're aware, and this particular chapter division may not be the best one. Anyway, Deuteronomy 4, verse 44. Now this is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel. These are the testimonies, the statutes, and the judgments which Moses spoke to the children of Israel after they came out of Egypt, on this side of the Jordan, in the valley opposite Beth Peor, in the land of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt at Heshbon, whom Moses and the children of Israel defeated after they came out of Egypt. And they took possession of his land in the land of Og, king of Bashan, two kings of the Amorites who were on this side of the Jordan, toward the rising of the sun, from Aroer, which is on the bank of the river Arnon, even to Mount Sion, that is Hermon, and all the plain on the east side of the Jordan, as far as the sea of the Arabah, below the slopes of Pisgah. And Moses called all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your hearing today, that you may learn them and be careful to observe them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, those who are here today, all of us who are alive. The Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire. I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up the mountain. He said, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, that your male servant and your female servant may rest, as well as you. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be long, and that it may be well with you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not desire your neighbor's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's." These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly, in the mountain from the midst of the fire, the cloud, and the thick darkness, with a loud voice. And he added no more. And he wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. Okay, so in our study of Deuteronomy, we've finally come to the giving of the Ten Commandments. We saw the first four chapters, except for that little bit I just read, are a historical prologue, which point to the good things that God has done for them and established God as their God, that covenant relationship, which was especially viewed as instituted at Sinai, is enforced, as well as God's goodness to them in bringing them into the land. And now he comes to the giving of the Ten Commandments. You remember they are called the covenant, or his covenant, earlier on in chapter 4. So it's really a central part of the book of Deuteronomy that we've reached. And let me just say a few words about that bit at the end of chapter 4. The setting is important for the re-giving, for the renewal of the covenant. And geographic location is there. But let me note again the emphasis on, in verses 47 and 48, on what God had done for them. They took possession of the land of Sihon, this is back in 46 actually, and Og, king of Bashan, So there's the reminder that it was God who brought them this far and who enabled them to take possession of the land of these mighty kings. Now, the Ten Commandments themselves then are preceded in chapter 5 by five verses which remind them of the setting of the original giving of the Ten Commandments, as well as an exhortation to obey what they're about to hear. So let me just highlight a few of these. I want to focus our time especially on the Ten Commandments themselves, but at least the first four of them. But let's think a little bit about what Moses says in preparation for that. Notice in verse 1 the reference to the call. So that term that's used there, call, means to assemble people together, as you might expect. But we saw before as an emphasis that they are the assembled ones. God could have given the Ten Commandments to them individually, but instead he calls them together in this assembly as the covenanted people of God. And that's the exhortation in verse 1. Hear, learn, and be careful to observe. So they first have to hear, but then there's some effort required. After you hear these things, you have to make some effort to learn them. And that's actually what Moses is going to spend most of the rest of the book of Deuteronomy doing, not learning them. That's the way you would say it in the South, maybe, but teaching them so that they would learn. And that requires, on their part, as I said, a certain diligence to not only pay attention and hear, but also to learn the lesson that is set before them. And then, of course, the learning would be of no value unless they actually observe them. So they're called to be careful, that word we've seen before, that they should observe what's put before them. Now, the mental aspects of this are quite prominent, but let me just highlight a couple of things in this. First is, of course, the direct reference to the covenant in verse 3. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers. Sorry, back up to verse 2. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The verb there is literally cut a covenant. You've probably heard this described before, and you can think of the rather weird scene in Genesis where Abraham cuts the animals in two and passes between them. So it's the same idea here. The one who makes a covenant typically takes on himself certain obligations, and with those obligations come sanctions, and the idea of being cut off if you fail to keep the sanctions is an important one. But here, the reference to God making a covenant with us is especially contrasted in verse 3 with the fact that God did not make a covenant with our fathers. Now, probably the fathers there refer to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And, well, as I just pointed out, God did make a covenant with them. But what he's saying is that this covenant, this special setting, and especially the clear declaration of God's will, wasn't something that the patriarchs had the benefit of. We may not think of it that way. We may think that it was a hard thing to be at the mountain and to have this terrifying presence of God. But here it's really put forth as an advantage that they had over the patriarchs. Patriarchs didn't have this covenant, but God did make this covenant with us. And strikingly, he says, with those who are here today, all of us who are alive. He's saying that God made the covenant at Sinai with all of those who are alive on the borders of the Promised Land. There's that covenantal solidarity again. Not all of the people who were alive then were alive back in Sinai. But he's saying that doesn't really matter. You are joined together as one people of God, so the covenant is really a covenant with you as well. And that many died in the wilderness, and this younger generation survived, is in some sense immaterial for the fact that they are all under the covenant. And that's why he's repeating the terms of the covenant to them, so that they would understand and respond to it. One striking aspect of this solidarity is missed unless you distinguish between the you singular and you plural. So here would be a plug for someone having the King James Version of the Bible, or having memorized the Ten Commandments in either the catechism form or in the form in the Exodus or Deuteronomy. Remember, it's always thou, right? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not commit murder. And if you remember your Elizabethan English grammar, that's you singular, whereas you plural is you. And thee is the accusative form of thou. So in all of the giving of the Ten Commandments, and even back in verse, in the early verses that we're looking at here, the opening, The emphasis is that God speaks to them in the singular. It's actually feminine singular. It's that the nation of Israel is treated as an individual person who is being addressed before God. And that's, again, the solidarity of the covenant. They are considered as one because of that. And as we tend to emphasize the terror of that encounter, which certainly is a good emphasis to have, notice also in verse 4, that the Lord talked with you face to face on the mountain. Now, as we saw earlier in Deuteronomy 4, there was a stress on the fact that God didn't actually appear to them. They saw no image. So face to face doesn't mean like you saw the face of God. But it does emphasize God's close presence with them. That's another advantage that they had. They had God speaking to them in a close way. And that we saw last week emphasized in Deuteronomy 4 because of the advantage that they had. What other nation had God so close to them? In a similar way, the advantage here is given that God spoke to them face to face.
Right. So the intimacy there, God speaking to them face to face, is important. Just a word of explanation. It says in verse 5 that I stood between the Lord and you at that time. That's probably, in terms of the flow of chapter 5, a little bit out of sequence. If you look after what I read in chapter 5, after the giving of the Ten Commandments, Moses expands on that point. Namely, they were terrified after the receiving of the Ten Commandments, and they asked Moses to be their mediator. And that's the point at verse 5. After what they had gone through, after the part we're going to look at today, then Moses spoke to them directly as opposed to God speaking to them directly. Okay, so those are some of the highlights of the preparation. Much of this is repetition from what we've seen in the opening chapters. But I want you to see, again, especially the emphasis on God's goodness to them in making a covenant with them and drawing them together to be one people and in revealing himself to them in this way. That was emphasized in chapter 4, and it's emphasized again here. The benefits not only of the covenant relationship, but also of a clear declaration of God's will. Okay? I mean, there may be some times when we would prefer a loosey-goosey declaration of God's will, but in fact, it's said here and in chapter 4 is a great benefit that they heard the word of God and actually heard it directly from God. Any comments or questions on that opening portion? Well, I want to then spend a little bit of time thinking about the Ten Commandments. Now, that sounds kind of silly because, right, people give extended studies on the Ten Commandments. We once, many years ago, went through the larger catechism section on the Ten Commandments in Sabbath School. And Dr. Spittler has an occasional afternoon/evening series in the same sort of thing. So one could spend a long time going through the Ten Commandments. I'm going to try to cover the first four today and the last six next week, as well as the rest of chapter 5. Maybe the bird's eye view will be helpful. I hope so. One advantage I have is that, Lord willing, we'll be studying the rest of the book of Deuteronomy, which is an exposition of the Ten Commandments. So if you understand how they were worked out in the civic life of the people and how they were worked out in other ways, well, stay tuned, and you'll see more of the explanation of the meaning of the Ten Commandments. But before we do that, I want to step back a little bit and think again about the purpose of the law, our relationship to the law, and specifically about the nature of the Ten Commandments. Because there is a lot of confusion. There are people who make errors on both sides of the question with respect to the law. Some people look to the law for justification. They wouldn't say it that way necessarily, but they expect that their acceptance with God is based on what they do, and that therefore emphasize, well, at least in principle, emphasize God's word. It tends to be their substitute for God's word in practice, but there is certainly a way to distort the giving of the Ten Commandments so as to forget the fact that it is not given for our justification. And on the other hand, there are those people are usually called legalists or neo-nomians. There are different terms that are used. But on the other hand, there are people who say that the law is really no more relevant for the believer. They may say specifically that the Ten Commandments are not relevant, or or even looser than that in terms of understanding the obligations from the New Testament. Those people are usually called antinomians, opposed to the law in some sense, or against the law. But both of those are errors. The Ten Commandments are given by God to whom? Well, what is the preface to the Ten Commandments? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. They're given to a people who are redeemed. Okay? That's why we studied the first four chapters of Deuteronomy first, right? God emphasized his goodness to them. He had saved them, as it were. There is no reason to expect that they would say, okay, now God is telling us what we need to do so that he will love us. He's already told them that he loves them, or that he will accept us. He has accepted them, and the ceremonial system pointed in that direction. But on the other hand, the Ten Commandments are clearly given to guide the people of God in all ages. I'll come back to that a little bit. I might as well address that now. The New Testament repeats the Ten Commandments in various ways. We saw that in the book of Romans. The Ten Commandments clearly have a special place in the law. They are spoken by God himself. They are set in stone, right? Because God wrote them on the tablets of stone, verse 22 here. And they are a summary of what's usually called the moral law. The moral law are those abiding commands of God that are not tied to a particular time or place, not tied to the ceremonies or typical of the coming of Christ. And again, it's very clear if you read the New Testament, the understanding of the abiding nature of the law. And as our Westminster Confession and the Catechism say, the moral law forever binds all. Whether you're a believer or an unbeliever, all are under the law of God. Although the specific way that works depends on whether you're a believer or unbeliever. Believers are certainly not under the law as a way of justification. Unbelievers are condemned for their failure to keep the law. Now, that understanding, the correction of the twofold errors, is summarized very well in a quote. This is a very familiar quote. If you look on the web, you can find it in lots of places. Samuel Bolton, who is a member of the Westminster Assembly, this is usually associated with his book, True Bounds of Christian Freedom. He says, the law sends us to the gospel for our justification. The gospel sends us to the law to frame our way of life. Okay, that's a good way of thinking of it. We're here to understand how to frame our way of life. And the book of Deuteronomy is teaching us that we would learn and obey his statutes. Okay. But especially as we go through these Ten Commandments, I want to emphasize a point that I brought up before in connection with the purposes of the law, and that is that the law makes us think of Christ. Not only think of Christ in the sense of our need for Christ, because we don't perfectly obey the law, but also to think of Christ in his perfect obedience of the law. So as we go through the first four this morning, Lord willing, we'll see how Christ himself fulfilled those and also emphasized their importance in his teaching. So, moving on in terms of general comments on the Ten Commandments, sometimes people react negatively to the Ten Commandments because they're largely worded in a negative way. Thou shalt not. Right? And it's true that that is true of most of them. It's not true, for example, of the Fourth Commandment, observe the Sabbath day or remember the Sabbath day in the Exodus account. But it is true that they're largely framed in a negative way. And here's an important principle of interpretation that we should remember. And that is, whenever you see a commandment framed in a negative way, you should realize that implicitly you're being commanded to do the positive duty. Okay, and the other way around, if you're told to do something positively, like love your neighbor, then you're not supposed to hate your neighbor. Okay, I think we could pretty easily pass in that direction. Maybe it's harder for us to pass in the other direction. I'm not sure. But what is the basis for believing that that's the case? Well, the teaching of Jesus, for example, or the teaching of Paul. How was it that Jesus referred to the law generally when he was asked about the greatest commandment? Actually, the greatest, and he gave the second is like unto it. It is to love God and to love our neighbor. That's a summary of the law, which is, of course, a positive statement. Or, and I put the reference up there, actually when Jesus does that in Mark 12, he's quoting from the next chapter of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 5. And the other, love our neighbor as ourselves, is from Leviticus 19. Or more recently, when we studied Romans, when Paul listed several of the Ten Commandments, thinking especially of the what's usually called the second table of the law, he says all of those are summarized in love your neighbor as yourself, again from Leviticus 19. So Paul and Jesus understood the negative aspects of the Ten Commandments as implying a positive aspect, love for God and love for our neighbor. Now, it would be interesting to conjecture why God worded them in a negative way. We could think about that for a while, but it's not really my purpose here. If you have some ideas, we can talk about it. But we should realize that the law, although it's largely framed in negative terms, is actually calling us to positive obedience to God. Now, there are other principles of interpretation like that are really very helpful in studying the Ten Commandments in more detail and in the law of God in general. And I'd encourage you to look at the Westminster Larger Catechism, question 99. That must have been one of the longest questions, because it has several rules for interpreting the law. And I'll just mention one other. That is that the law is spiritual. And what they mean by that is that when the commandment says, thou shalt not murder, it doesn't thereby restrict only physical violence, but it also condemns hatred in the heart. Jesus, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount brings out that point. So that's just one aspect. We shouldn't interpret the law as binding only superficial aspects, if you want to call murder superficial, but we should realize that it touches on matters of the heart. And there's several others in the larger catechism I'd encourage you to look at as very helpful rules for interpretation. Okay. Let me make a few comments about numbering. Okay. There are 10 commandments. Earlier in Deuteronomy, it says, I give you the 10 words. Okay, so everyone agrees there have to be 10. But not everyone agrees on the numbering of the 10. The traditional Reformed, and I mean that as opposed to the Lutheran. So basically the Protestant, except for Lutheran, understanding of the numbering is the one I think we're familiar with, so I won't describe it any further. But to give you the contrast, the Roman Catholic and the Lutheran interpretation combines what we call the first two commandments into one commandment. So the forbidding of having other gods in verse 7 and the forbidding of making carved images and worshiping them in verses 8 and 9 and 10. So that's actually a Reformed interpretation of what they say. But those verses are combined into one commandment in the Roman Catholic understanding. Okay, so we do remember our arithmetic a little bit. That means you got to split one of the others, right? Because there are 10 altogether for sure. And they split the last commandment into two. Don't covet your neighbor's household. That's one. And then don't covet your neighbor's wife and so on. That's another. It's a little bit problematic because the version of it in Deuteronomy is different from the one in Exodus, so they start with different things. Anyway, that is the traditional Roman Catholic and Lutheran interpretation. In the Roman Catholic case, it helps because they tend to want to use graven images, and I'm not going to get into why it helps to combine the two. There's another possible numbering of them, which is to take what we call the preface, verse 6, and call that the first commandment, which looks kind of weird, but that's another system that some have used. The Jews, for example, historically have used that. And then again, usually it's the last of the commandments that's split into two. Okay. I'm not going to take any time to defend the traditional Protestant Reformed understanding of the division of the commandments. It seems fairly straightforward, and I'll just assume that that's what we're going to use. Usually, we understand the commandments as being divided into two portions. The first four commandments especially emphasize our duty to God, and the last six emphasize our duty to man. So starting with honor your father and your mother and so on, those have to do especially with our duty to man. You can find that again in the Westminster Standards. It's a very common understanding. And that's a very helpful understanding. People, I mentioned this before, people refer to those as the two tables of the law. That doesn't mean necessarily that the tables that are referred to later, the tablets, had, you know, the first four on one and the last six on another. They're probably duplicates of each other. That is, both tablet contained all six commandments. But that way of in splitting them up is a very helpful one. I myself am going to use it this morning, trying to get through the first four. But we should realize that it has its limitations. That is, it's dangerous to separate them completely. After all, what does the Apostle Paul say about the last commandment, covetousness? He says it's idolatry, which means it's a violation of the first commandment, right? And so there, if you want to look at a sin, you can look at it from the point of view of many different commandments. And it's dangerous to try to separate them too radically. After all, our duty to man is ultimately there because of our duty to God. And as we emphasize, the spirituality of the law means that often the heart issues that you might think of in connection with the last commandment, coveting, are a motivation in the other sins, in committing murder and committing adultery and so on. So although that division is helpful, you shouldn't overuse it. You should realize that the law is one. And the law addresses us as whole people and realizes who we are and calls us to obey God. Okay. You may not think that so, but that was a very brief general reflection on the law and the Ten Commandments. And the next thing is to try to look at each of the first four individually, briefly. Any comments or questions so far, though? Anyone have an alternative numbering?
On the Jewish numbering, if they made verse 6, is that what you said? They made that a commandment?
Mm-hmm.
So then did they combine?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said split. See, I'm only a mathematician, sorry. I should have said they combine what we call the first and second commandments.
Yes. Oh, okay, they still did. Okay.
Yeah. No, right. If you add one, then you have to combine and not split.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah. You'd have too many. Yeah, so they would see verse 6 as the first commandment and verses 7 through 10 as the second commandment. Does that make sense? So like the Roman Catholic understanding.
Except I don't follow how verse 6 is a commandment.
I don't either. It's important, but I don't think see it as a commandment.
You did command them to come out of
right. Right, yeah. Right. No, I didn't do enough reading on it to know what the argument is. So, any other comments? Okay. So, let's look, well, first briefly at the preface and then also at the first four commandments. So, you might do a little mental exercise while I'm talking. Suppose you had 20 minutes to talk about the first four commandments. So, say 5 minutes per commandment if you want to ignore the preface. What would you say about each of them? Okay. That's the sort of thing I had to face, and it's kind of interesting to see how you can briefly summarize something. As I mentioned before, there are long discussions in the larger catechism, and we've gone through those, but suppose you have to briefly summarize them. What would you say? What is the essence of them? And here, as I mentioned before, I especially want to emphasize the fact that Christ supremely is the law keeper. He kept the law, you might say, not on his behalf, but on our behalf. He needed, of course, as a one born under the law to keep the law, but he was there as our mediator. That's an important point. Okay, so first the preface. It is there in verse 6. The covenant relationship is emphasized. I am the Lord your God. But especially it's identifying the one who is making this. It is, if you want to think of this, you know, the suzerain vassal model. Here is the overlord. He identifies himself. I am Yahweh, the one who spoke to Moses back in Exodus. It's the same phrase, I am the Lord. And God declares himself, therefore, not only as the Lord, but also as the one who entered into covenant with them and the one who redeemed them. He brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Now, that idea of bondage actually comes up again in Deuteronomy in the description of the fourth commandment, so we'll come back to that. But notice the idea is, because I am the Lord, because we have this relationship, because of what I have done for you, therefore pay attention. Okay? If you like, the preface is the first four chapters of Deuteronomy compressed into one verse. Okay, even the opening part of chapter 5. It is a repetition of the fact that God has shown such great love to them. God has cared for them. God has redeemed them, and therefore he has a right to expect obedience, and of before obedience of hearing and learning, as we saw in verse 1. Now, that sort of exhortation should be familiar to us from the New Testament, so I put up a couple of references. Think of 1 Corinthians 6:20, you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God. I think we're familiar with that verse. So there's the same sort of emphasis. We have been redeemed by God, and we are therefore under obligation to glorify God. In 1 Corinthians 6, it especially has to do with sexual sin. So it's a very concrete application there of the fact that God has redeemed us. Now, the first commandment, as we discussed, is in verse 7. You shall have no other gods before me. How would you state that in a positive way? Well, we'll do the two birds with one stone. Let's see how Jesus did use it in a positive way. So turn with me to Luke chapter 4, verse 8. I need a new marker. We also need to clean the board again. It's a bad combination of smudges with a light marker. But that's Luke 4, 8. Jesus is here being tempted in the wilderness. We looked at this passage before in terms of Jesus is, in a sense, redoing what Adam and especially what Israel did, but doing it right and resisting temptation and following God. And here in Luke 4, Satan has just tempted Jesus and says, if you will worship before me, all will be yours. And here's Jesus' answer. Jesus answered and said to him, get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve. Well, there's a positive statement of the first commandment. It's actually a quotation from the next chapter in Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 6:13. It is a statement of the fact that God is the only one worthy of our worship and service. And that reminds us, just to make the point clear, that Jesus was perfectly obedient in this commandment. Jesus was tempted by Satan to give over all, to worship Satan so that he would have all the kingdoms of the earth. And he refused on the basis of the first commandment. He is the perfectly righteous one. Now that statement that we should worship God only has been underlined already in Deuteronomy. The opening chapters of Deuteronomy especially warned against idolatry of, as we saw, both kinds, both the worship of another God and the worship of the true God in a false way. And here the highlight at the end of it is, you shall have no other gods before me. Each of the first three commandments especially emphasizes how that particular sin is an affront to God. And here, having any other gods before me is it's an in-your-face sin, if we could use a modern version of it. It is to insult God in that way. And the commandment thereby warns us the seriousness of this sin as an affront to the one who has redeemed us and brought us to be his own. The second commandment is the longer in statement. It's verses 8 through 10. And the second commandment has to do, as we noted before, with the making of graven images. This came up especially in Deuteronomy 4 and was motivated by the fact that they saw no image when God spoke to them at Sinai, and therefore they are not to make any images of God. But it then applies more generally to the worship of God. And so a brief statement of the second commandment is that God is to be worshipped in the way he is appointed. And in particular, we are not to make images to represent God, and certainly not to use them to worship him. Now, it is a longer commandment. Let me notice, first of all, the aspect that Jesus highlighted in his teaching. I put up a couple of passages, one from Matthew 15, and maybe in the interest of time, we won't look at these, the others from John 4. But Jesus, in dealing with the Pharisees who wanted to add to God's law, ritual washings, and he says thereby took away from God's law in the lack and detracting from honoring parents, says specifically, you worship me in vain, for your commandments are only the teachings of men. So there he's emphasizing the fact that when we worship God, he's actually quoting from Isaiah when he says that when we worship God, we have to worship according to his will and not worship him in the way that we would devise. Or John 4:23-24, Jesus says, those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. So there's Jesus applying in specific situations the commandment in here in Deuteronomy, a parallel in Exodus 20, that when we worship God, we are to worship according to his will, and we're not to add to his will, and we're to recognize the nature of God as the God of who is the God of spirit, who is a spirit, and the God of truth, and therefore worship according to truth. Okay. It's a longer commandment. I'm going to be briefer on that part because, well, as I said, all of this stuff comes up later in Deuteronomy, so we can come back to it. Let me notice particular the reasons annexed. I think that's the phrase the larger catechism uses here. And the reason annexed occupies the last part of verse 9 and all of verse 10. Why should they not do this? Because, first of all, God is a jealous God. We talked about that fact in Deuteronomy 4. There was a reference there to the jealousy of God. It is the picture of zeal within conjugal love to protect the marriage bond. And God is saying, in effect, that this altering the way that God is to be worshipped is provoking him to jealousy. Whether it leads directly to idolatry, which seems to happen in every case that I know of in the Bible, like they set up the golden calf, and originally it's identified as Yahweh, as the Lord, and then, you know, 5 minutes later they're dancing around it as if it's some other god that they're serving. So it's clear that there is a tendency to move from the second commandment to the first commandment. So in that sense, identifying them, although I think as false, has a ring of truth to it, or an element of truth to it. That is, they are closely related to each other. But there's another understanding of this which is quite interesting, and that is that the tendency is to place, when you make an image of God, the tendency is to manipulate God by it and to place ourselves over God and to replace the true God by the thing we have made with our own hands in terms of our affections. And therefore, jealousy is a reasonable description of God's reaction to that. Okay, we could talk about this more, but let me just notice how God describes both the sanctions and the blessings associated with this commandment. It says that he visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Now again, we've talked about the solidarity of the covenant, and this is an expression of that, that those who serve God by graven images tend to entangle their own children in it, and their own children suffer because of it. Their own children, you might say, are not innocents who are suffering simply because of the sins of their fathers. We had a sermon on that in Ezekiel recently, but it is the case that the children of those who are idolaters suffer further. In family worship, we're reading through 1 Kings now, and you can see how that actually works out in practice. When you have an evil king, not only does his generation suffer, but the later generations suffer as well. Notice how this disobedience is described. It's those who hate me. Serving God by images is hating God. I'm sure they didn't think of it that way. They would rather prefer describe it as creativity or using their imagination in worship or something like that. But God describes it as hating him. Having said that, I don't really want to emphasize that aspect of the sanction. I'd rather emphasize the blessing because the emphasis seems to fall there. If the iniquity is visited on the fathers to the third and fourth generation, how many generations receive mercy? Thousands. That's my understanding. I think this is the right way to understand it. It's not merely that thousands of people receive mercy, but that thousands of generations receive mercy. The word mercy there is that word chesed that we looked at in Ruth. It's God's covenant faithfulness. And he's saying that God's mercy and love are so great that he blesses to 1,000 generations. And notice the way their obedience is described. They love him. in contrast to hating God. So keeping this commandment is loving God, and it will be worked out in the keeping of his commandments. Calvin, in commenting on this emphasis on the love and mercy of God, says this: God wills to be known as good and merciful, and it is in that that his glory principally shines. So here, again, the commandments, which we may think of as a terrifying thing and is given in a negative way, have here a sort of a sweet incentive to obedience, because we can bless not only ourselves but future generations by loving God. And, of course, worshiping him is the greatest joy there can be, as we do it with our whole hearts. Okay. Rushing through. I don't know if I've done 5 minutes per command or not. Rushing through, the third commandment is briefer. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. So notice again there's a strong statement: the Lord will not hold him guiltless. It is a serious thing to take God's name in vain. Now, normally when we think of taking God's name in vain, we think of people who casually swear using the name of God. And certainly that is condemned by this commandment. Gerhardus Voss, in his book Biblical Theology, points out that in the ancient world, the use of the name had a rather different effect. He actually wonders whether people who swear this way in our day still have some remnants of that in their mind. The name was a very important thing in the ancient world. If you knew someone's name, if you understood someone's name, you had a certain power in connection with that person. And using someone's name in vain would mean manipulating that God to accomplish your own purposes. Okay, in vain means to a useless end. There are various words that are used in the Hebrew to translate the Hebrew word that's described here in vain. But to vanity is probably a good enough translation. So the idea that you could manipulate a god by putting a curse on someone using that god's name and thereby accomplish your own purposes, even though you had no regard to that god himself, that god is simply a convenient means of getting your will done on someone else. That was the sense of it in the ancient world. And it's, of course, that is really at the heart of what God is talking about here, whether we think in terms of that sort of manipulation using magic or whether we think of someone casually swearing. It is regarding God as a light thing. It is saying that God's word, who God is, what God does in providence and history, mean nothing to me. I only care about myself. And I will disregard them or use them as I will according to my own desire. And that, for that reason, God takes it as a very serious thing. God will not hold the person who does that as someone who's innocent. How did Jesus show this and teach this in his teaching? What is the first part of the Lord's Prayer? Hallowed be thy name. Which is a positive statement of this third commandment. Sorry, that's the way we usually pray it. I think in a modern translation it would be something like, may your name be held holy. Okay, the opposite of taking God's name in vain is to treat God and all that is associated with God, his word and his works, as holy, to receive them as holy. And certainly Jesus not only taught that and taught us to pray that way, but lived that way in his life. Okay. The fourth commandment, in 5 minutes. The fourth commandment has to do with the keeping of the Sabbath day. Jesus here dealt with a misunderstanding and misuse of the Sabbath, again by the Pharisees and others with whom he dealt. And he positively corrected them and said the Sabbath is not made for man, but man for the Sabbath. But he also said the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath, thereby indicating that it was in his domain, and he was the right interpreter of it. So that's Mark 2:27-28. There are other parallels in the Synoptic Gospels. So Jesus certainly did not put aside the Sabbath as a day of rest. Instead, he reinforced it, but enforced the proper understanding of it. Now, it would be tempting to go into a longer discussion of the Sabbath because this is the one of the Ten Commandments that's most explicitly challenged. I mean, you know, there's plenty of adultery in America and there's plenty of other sins, but in terms of the commandments that are formally recognized or not recognized as binding, this is probably the one that people would look at first. But I'm going to try to resist that temptation since, again, we have the rest of Deuteronomy to study this. And let me just make a few comments in connection with it. The first thing you might notice or might have noticed when I read the account here is that, or sorry, the statement here of the fourth commandment is that it's not the same as the statement in Exodus. Okay? If you've memorized the catechism, a larger or shorter catechism, or if you've memorized the statement of the Ten Commandments in Exodus, you'll realize that the reason in verse 15 of Deuteronomy is missing from the statement in Exodus. Other reasons are supplied elsewhere. Let me just, before we look at the reason that's given here, let me remind you of some of the reasons that are given both in the Exodus account and also in other parts of the law. The first motivation, and this is from the Exodus account, is that God rested on the Sabbath day. And God sanctified the Sabbath day. God set it apart. He made it holy. Elsewhere it's called a sign of the covenant between God and his people. Elsewhere it's called the day of assembly. So that had a practical function. That was the day on which they could come before God as one. And it's also called the day of rest, which is probably what we normally think of in connection with the Sabbath. But here the emphasis is that it's the day of liberation. Okay, so we have liberation theology today. So here they are to remember in verse 15 that they were slaves in the land of Egypt. Now God had already pointed that out in the preface. He brought them out of the house of bondage. But the fact that they were slaves in Egypt underlines the fact that they should therefore have compassion on their slaves, and that's emphasized again here in the giving of the fourth commandment at the end of verse 14, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. Okay? Agrarian life is hard. Okay? If your servant never gets a day off, never gets to rest, the servant is probably going to die young, even younger than you will, and it's a terrible life to live. And they knew that because that's the way they were treated in Egypt, right? In Egypt, they didn't get a day off. That was the whole point in going to Pharaoh, give us a day so we can go and worship God. Not even one day of the week. Let's just have one day where we can go and worship God. And Pharaoh, who is a harsh taskmaster, refuses to give them rest. They're supposed to remember that. When you think of the Sabbath day, he says, in effect, remember, you didn't get any rest. You were a slave. But, verse 15, the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand. I hope my voice will make it. And by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. It is a reminder, then, not only that they should have mercy on their own servants, but it is a motivation to realize that they have been set free by God. And if you will, it is a reminder that there will be a great liberation at the final day. This is a point that I'm afraid people tend to forget, and this is a place where I would be tempted to go further on, but I'm not going to. And that is that there is a reason for the sequence, even at creation, of the Sabbath. They were to work 6 days and to rest, to point forward to the fact that this world had an end ahead. It is not an endless cycle of history, but there would be a final consummation in which they would enter into God's rest as God rested. We talked about that a little bit when we looked at Hebrews 3 and 4 earlier in Deuteronomy. But here then they can look forward to the final and ultimate liberation from sin, from the bondage to which they still the bondage they were still in, and so far as they were still not completely sanctified by God. Let me close just with a comment about the Sabbath to tie back to the beginning of the chapter. It's nice to have these little inclusios. So remember at the beginning I said that I emphasized the fact that we as those who hear the commandments of God in verse 1 are to hear and learn and observe. How many of us have enough time through the week to hear and learn and observe God's Word? Okay? If you work 7 days a week, if you have no time for the set apart for the worship of God, then you will not have the opportunity to learn the way you need to learn, nor to cultivate the piety and the good sense that being careful to observe them is. There's a beautiful metaphor of Calvin in his sermons on Deuteronomy. He says that the Sabbath day is like a tower. I've used this metaphor before because I think it's really helpful. And on the Lord's day, you can enter into the tower, and you can, from that tower, contemplate the wonderful things that God has done. In creation, certainly, but especially in terms of the imagery here of the redemption that God has brought. We should also think of, from that tower, meditating and observing all the things that God has done to save us as his people. Okay, we don't have to, most of us, work hard labor 7 days a week. But we have lots of gadgets that keep us from paying attention and focusing on things. We have lots of interruptions. We have lots of anxieties. I'm not sure that email makes work farther away. I think it makes work closer, and I'm not sure what texting and other things do. It's a great opportunity for us to sit back and to think about what God has done. It is a blessing. The Sabbath was made for man so that we would contemplate the works of God. Okay, well, that was more like 8 minutes. Any comments or questions about any of the material we talked about? John?
I don't know if you can give an answer real short to this, but as far as the second commandment goes, I'm trying to think about how that might apply today, just because I don't worship carved images and wooden things, but maybe I was thinking maybe not even just like crucifixes and images and stuff, but maybe that's part of it, but also just people or myself, like, I think Jesus is this way or God's this way. This is how I want to see him or without the word. I don't know.
Yeah, that's certainly a violation of the Ten Commandments to make God in our own image, as it were. I think one way that comes up is the tendency to emphasize the, shall we say, sensual aspects of worship as opposed to the focus on God revealing himself by his word, and the sacraments are associated with that also. So the tendency is tend to be historically in the Roman Catholic Church not only to have the images but also to have all of these other things there which couldn't actually communicate the truth of God, and they're actually failed to communicate the truth of God. And I think to some extent the contemporary church falls into the same thing. You don't want to be like just completely word-oriented so that there's no sacraments or any other aspects. But there is a tendency, I think, in the contemporary church to replace the word of God with other things that stimulate our senses and are entertaining. I mean, I think the Word of God is entertaining too, but it, you know, maybe not in as edifying a sense. Generally, historically, the Reformed have understood the Second Commandment as saying that God is to be worshipped according to His will, more generally. So the creation of graven images was one way in which men added to the worship of God, because God didn't give them an image, but they decided they wanted to have one. And so that opens up all kinds of discussion about that. It's basically the sufficiency of Scripture applied to worship is what...
It's kind of like regulative principle.
Right, that's the regulative principle is usually understood as coming from the Second Commandment. But I was only doing a 5-minute version, right? And we've still got Deuteronomy 12 and lots of other things ahead of us, so at some point we could talk about that. But I will say that the last chapter, Deuteronomy, does develop those ideas, especially that fact that God didn't give them an image and so they weren't to make an image. That sense of... being content with what God has given us is an important thing. You knew I couldn't give a short answer. Yeah, I saw that hedging even originally. You just know me and know I can't give a short answer. So. Sorry. Any other questions? Yes, Jeff.
So on this business of combining the first two commandments.
Okay. Yeah.
So one aspect of it then is that the I guess you could say it sort of excuses using graven images
right.
of worship because you say, oh, those aren't part of, that's not another God. It's just a representative God.
Right.
The first God.
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't make that explicit, but that's the argument. So you shall not worship other gods. That's the subject of this commandment on this reading. Subject is not worshiping other gods. And therefore, making graven images must refer to worshiping other gods. And it therefore allows making graven images of the one true God in worship.
So, and I was wondering then if it also, the flip side of that is that it combines, it sort of limits worshiping other gods more to graven images and not to
purpose. Yeah.
So
I don't know. That's a good question. It might. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it would be very convenient for us if we could only worship other gods, if only it was limited to wooden images and so on.
Right.
We'd have it made then.
Right.
Most
of the idols of the heart would escape
yes.
from that. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's close in prayer.